For breakfast, I had a tuna fish sandwich from Subway.
It's funny that you got tuna, though, because we're talking about whitefish today.
I know. Well, I mean, I'm consistent in taste.
There we go. There we go. Welcome to Smart Mouth, the podcast where we discover more about our favorite people via their favorite foods.
Thanks, Catherine.
Everybody, today our guest is Tuesday Bassin. She is an illustrator and the owner of Friend Mart. You can find that on the internet if you're not in Los Angeles at friend-mart.com. When we were talking about what your favorite food was, I thought maybe it might be strawberries just because you use strawberries so much in your art.
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite motif. And I have a strawberry tattoo.
You do?
Yeah, on my arm. I'll show you.
Oh, you have a lot of tattoos.
Yeah.
Oh, that strawberry is like kind of realistic.
Yeah, I mean, realistic.
Yeah.
It's like, I have a tan right now. Well, tan for me. And so it's like it's a little blown out, but.
No, that's really cool.
I've had a lot of chefs ask me if I'm a chef based on that tattoo. And I didn't realize that was like a common chef tattoo is like a realistic version of whatever
absolutely
food was.
Absolutely. That or a utensil or a pig that's portioned out into the different cuts. Those are classic chef things.
I saw Andy Richter, is that his last name that owns Pock Pock?
Ricker.
Mm-hmm. I saw him at the coffee shop I go to every day in Chinatown because my shop is right next to Pock Pock in Chinatown. And he has a durian in the same position, like same level of detail as my strawberry.
Did you take a photo with it?
No, but we kind of did like a, hey, nice tattoo.
I love that. So you like the art of strawberries, but you decided that your actual favorite food was whitefish.
Yes.
And you called it whitefish pate.
I feel like that's my Midwestern grandmother trying to like dress it up a little bit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why you called it pate, but I was like, where is she from? And I didn't want to ask you before we started recording because that seems like such a regionalism because I've heard whitefish salad and I've heard just whitefish and in context, you know that it's like whitefish salad, but you said whitefish pate.
Well, I also feel like, you know, maybe my family called it whitefish pate because we usually have it like a dressed up version around the holidays. And I'm a super suck up grandchild. And so I like go hours before everybody else comes for holidays and prepares it with my grandmas. Yeah.
And what kind of holidays are we talking here? Jewish holidays or like Christmas?
Christmas, Thanksgiving.
And so whitefish pate is like a mainstay at these?
Yeah, for sure. Well, German Scandinavian is like my background.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of like pickled fish and like lefse and...
What's lefse?
It's like a... Lefse is like a tortilla kind of.
Okay.
It's like super incredible, really thin dough that you can like make like pinwheels or just eat the lefse plain or with like sugar or something.
Okay.
But it's, I feel like you're hard pressed to find it unless you live like maybe in the Midwest where like, you know, Scandinavian grandmas are making it in a basement or something.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which part of the Midwest in particular?
Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Yeah. But most of my family is from Minnesota.
Does everyone consider Nebraska the Midwest?
Yes. It is the absolute middle of the country.
That makes sense.
Although I had a conversation with somebody who lived in Colorado yesterday, and they were really offended when I said that Colorado was in the Midwest, even though it touches Nebraska. They're like, okay, we're the West. And I was like, okay, bitch, well, clearly it's, you live in the fucking Midwest, so get over it.
That's, wow, that got, that like escalated quickly.
I know, heated.
I like it, though. I like people with strong opinions.
Like, you still would have to travel, like, 20 hours to hit the West. Like, it's not the West Coast. You're still in the Midwest.
Well, what do you call Nevada?
That's the West Coast.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'll allow that.
Yeah. I'll allow it.
So, this whitefish pate version, I have some questions about it.
Yeah.
What do you mix in with the whitefish?
Well, okay, so it's not that different than like a typical whitefish salad.
Okay.
That would be at like a Jewish deli, but we mix in like stronger cheese spreads with it.
Oh.
And specifically do like smoked whitefish instead of just like a maybe baked or something like that. Okay. So there's like a
but cheese
flavor. Yeah.
Like beyond cream cheese, like a
beyond cream cheese. I can't even I wish I would have like thought more about what my family recipe was before coming on here so I could like confirm like finitely like yes, this is what is in the whitefish pate, but
yeah. It's probably just like a couple herbs and spices but not too many, and then like something to make it spreadable or dippable. What do you spread it on? Crackers? Okay.
On baguettes.
Oh, well, well, elegant. I know. So fancy. So I think that when most people think of like white fish salad, like within context, we'll just call it white fish. We mean white fish salad, yeah, or spread or pate. It's got maybe onions or celery or pickles or white pepper in it,
yes,
for seasoning. And then some people say cream cheese. Some people say mayonnaise. Some people say sour cream. Russ and Daughters is kind of like the standard bearer for white fish.
I was just in New York. I just got back.
Yeah.
And the first stop I made was to Russ and Daughters, and I had the whitefish.
I totally got sandwich. It is a life-changing dish.
Oh, it's so good. Have you been to the cafe yet?
I haven't, no. Only they the have takeout. Like,
they have a whitefish sandwich that's just on, like, it's open face, and it has wasabi-infused roe on top, uh-huh, like fish eggs, and it's so good.
It's that ridiculous. Sounds amazing. You have to be down with seafood to get into something like that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love, like, going to Jewish delis, and that's my favorite, because obviously I can't even think of one place in Los Angeles where you could, you know, go to, like, a Scandinavian style.
Oh, yeah, we don't do Scandinavian at all.
No.
I'm from Seattle, so I am a little bit familiar with that kind of stuff. Not as much as you, though, for sure. We don't. Yeah, the East Coast, West Coast divide on, like, deli food and appetizing, which is the kind of store that sells whitefish. We don't really have it so much. Russ and Daughters, so they have their quote-unquote recipe on Martha Stewart's site, but they say that they put mayonnaise in it, and I don't believe that might be in it, but that can't be the only mix.
It's, like, not mayonnaise-y.
Exactly.
At all.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that maybe it's mayonnaise and cream cheese, and they just don't want to, like, give away the secret. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're like, we'll tell you some of it.
Yeah. What they do tell you is that they also put kippered salmon in it, which is hot smoked salmon, because the white fish of Russ and Daughters is, like, a little bit pink. There's salmon in it. You're right. It's so good, though. It's the best. And then I was, like, doing my research on this, and all of a sudden it was like, what the fuck is whitefish? I don't know what that means. So I looked it up, and I guess it's like any sort of neutral fish that happens to be white.
That sounds very weird.
I know, right? Like, I guess it can be like a lot of different things. It can be cod, pollock, haddock, hake, which is like a fish that I don't think we talk about very much, but Matilda likes hake. And it's funny because you are from the Midwest, which is like a place where whitefish is esteemed in the same way that it is in New York.
Right. Well, it's interesting too, because being from Nebraska, obviously there's no bodies of water nearby. And I went to school in Minneapolis.
Okay.
For college. And it was like my duty to like go and pick up like whitefish from the grocery store or the fishmonger in Minneapolis, bring back the fish in the bed of my pickup truck for the holidays. So, yeah, is it esteemed in the Midwest? Maybe in like the northern
parts. Yeah, I think it's like in the Great Lakes they have various. Because I know that some of the, even the like the East Coast appetizing stores, some will like be like, oh, we get it from the Pacific or the Atlantic. And some say we get it from the Great Lakes.
Right. Well, there's Maury's Seafood in Maury, Minnesota, which is like it's actually a fairly large like fish store that I think supplies a lot of the Midwest and like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
The East Coast with it. It's pretty amazing. My grandma's have a cabin in northern Minnesota, and whenever I drive up there, I like stop at Maury's along the way.
Nice.
I feel like I'm outing myself as like a weird whitefish freak.
Well, that's great. We're all about whitefish freaks, or freaks of any stripe, really. So this is good. We should like back up and talk about what appetizing means. because there's the appetizing stores in New York. And no one really knows why they were called that, but they are different from delicatessens. So it's, I guess you could say that it started in Eastern Europe because in Eastern European Jewish food, they have, they start the big like celebratory meals with cold appetizers, and those are known as forshpes. I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's in Yiddish, so I have no idea what I'm doing. And then like the Jews moved to New York, they brought that tradition with them. Kosher law dictates that you can't mix meat and dairy.
Right.
You can mix fish and meat, but I guess it was decided that it was easier to have meat stores, which are delis where you buy your meats.
Right.
And then to have like fish, dairy, egg stores. And they decided to call those appetizing for some reason. So that's for people who really keep kosher because, again, the meat can't go with dairy. So at an appetizing store, you're going to find stuff like smoked salmon, pickled herring, the whitefish, sable, bagels, bluefish, lox, smoked trout, smoked mackerel, sturgeon, caviar if you're fancy. And then the things that you would, the accompaniments to those, red onions, tomatoes, cucumbers, capers, and just plain cream cheese as well. I guess Matilda has a lot to say about.
She's very passionate about whitefish.
Yeah. We have a new neighbor dog in the building and she hasn't gotten used to him yet. So there's a lot of outrage. And then, of course, the delis, they specialize in the meat. But one of my favorite terms is Jew-ish. It definitely describes me. So now there are Jew-ish shops that sell, like, meat and dairy. And even, like, most of the, like, eat-in delis, definitely on the West Coast, aren't actually kosher. They're kosher style.
Right. For sure.
Like, Reubens. You shouldn't be allowed to eat Reubens, but they
doesn't
have
those. Doesn't Russ Cafe sell, like, beef sandwiches as well? I think it does. It
beef is allowed. Yes. Oh, you're right. Yes. So it's not, it's kosher,
kosher style.
Yeah, kosher style. Yeah, I believe, because I think that a lot of people who are like really strictly keeping kosher maybe aren't going out into these secular style restaurants anyway. For is sure. My guess. And appetizing food is specifically used for breaking the fast after Yom Kippur because you can't cook during Yom Kippur, so you have pre-made food the day after. That makes good sense.
Yeah.
That's some logic. But it's like a New York term that no one else uses it, even though these types of stores exist in there. What I love about Russ and Daughters, which we obviously can't stop talking about because it's so good, is that when it opened in 1914, it was called Russ's Cut-Rate Appetizers.
Russ and Daughters sounds so much better.
Right?
Cut-Rate Appetizers sounds like bottom of the barrel.
It fish. Sure does. It sure does. It's really cool that he named it Russ and Daughters as opposed to Russ and Sons, too.
Yeah.
It was like a very conscious, progressive move that he made to do that, which is so dope. He did have daughters, but he could have lied about it.
Yeah.
But I think that's neat.
Drag in the appetizing store.
Yeah.
So are my sons.
That could have worked. That could have been a thing. That was back when New York was crazy. You lived in New York, so did you know that whitefish was, like, when did you transition from, like, calling it pate to just whitefish?
Well, one of my best friends, Adam J. Kurtz, I called it whitefish pate in front of him, and he was like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's a whitefish salad. What's wrong with you? And he grew up Orthodox Jewish, and so I think he's, like, very, like, what? No. Don't try to fancy this up. That's not what that is.
That's funny. And did he, was he the one who like took you to discover Russ and Daughters, or did you find that on your own?
Yeah, I think that I had been to the deli, but the cafe hadn't opened until around the time that I was starting to leave. Mm-hmm. Actually, a friend of mine did all the design for the cafe.
Oh, very cool.
Kelly Anderson. She's super talented. But I think I actually did go with him for the first time, but I had wanted to go kind of on my own. And then, yeah, I feel like I've toured a lot of different delis and appetizing places in New York, like over the years of living there.
Do you like the stuff that your family makes better?
It's nostalgic, so maybe, but I wouldn't know. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily better, actually.
Right. Right. Okay. And then, what do you do living in LA to get your whitefish fix?
Well, my friend Evan owns Yeasty Boys Bagel Truck.
Oh.
And I teamed up with him and I had my own bagel for a while.
Wow.
I did a patch for the truck and it was called the Bagel, like B-A-E-G-E-L.
And yeah.
It was a whitefish bagel.
Okay.
So that was fun while it lasted. And then Wexler's in Santa Monica has like a really amazing whitefish bagel.
Okay.
The one downtown doesn't have it though. It's really weird.
My understanding is that they don't have the space to do that downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they do in the Santa Monica
location. It's great.
That's
I don't know. I feel like... Obviously, I just told you that I ate a tuna fish sandwich for breakfast at Subway. But I don't know. Tuna fish is also super nostalgic for me. It's like a low-grade white fish salad. But I think I ate tuna fish every day in elementary school growing up.
Really?
Yeah. I always woke up before my parents because I'm like a super early riser. And my parents are... really young as well, and they were like would always sleep in, and so I would like get myself ready for school, and then I would make myself a tuna fish sandwich every day and then go wake up my mom to take me to school.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
So self-sufficient.
That's me. Sometimes I would like not wake her up in the morning and then I would get in really big trouble, so I was like, okay, well, I guess I know my limits.
Oh,
I have to be the responsible one here.
What's your tuna fish sandwich recipe?
Well, okay. For a long time, I, like, wasn't putting anything in it except for, like, tuna fish and mayonnaise mm-hmm. on whole wheat.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've gotten older, I've, like, tried to be less disgusting.
There's nothing disgusting about that.
I feel like you have to add in some vegetables or something. Otherwise, you're just eating, like, so much mayonnaise and
yeah.
canned fish.
But putting other stuff in it doesn't decrease the amount of mayonnaise, though.
Well, over the years, I've tried to cut back on the mayonnaise and mostly do mustard.
I haven't been able to switch it over into mostly mustard. I feel like mine is still mostly mayonnaise, but like increasing amounts of mustard.
So equal parts mayonnaise and mustard?
Yeah,
probably.
You just
have like a really wet sandwich now?
No, no. It's like only a tiny, tiny amount of each.
Okay.
And then I've been putting in like relish and dried cranberries.
Whoa.
And then arugula on the sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have cheddar. I don't like sandwiches on untoasted bread.
Oh, really? I hate toasted sandwiches.
What?
Yeah. Controversial.
I know. Totally. Why do you hate toasted sandwiches?
I don't know. I just feel like it's such a pleasure to eat bread that it like ruins it if it's like you can't get that like super chewy texture.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can respect that.
Yeah.
So what else do you put in yours?
So usually now it's like cucumbers,
okay,
spinach or arugula,
uh-huh.
maybe kale if I don't have anything else, and I've just been eating salad, and then mustard, mayonnaise. I think that's probably about it.
You're still keeping it like relatively simple.
Yeah, or I've started to like put like oil and vinegar instead of mayonnaise.
Oh, so elegant.
I'm trying really hard to like cut the mayonnaise. I'm making up for like years of overeating mayonnaise.
That's really funny. So this Yeasty Boys, for those of you who are not in Los Angeles, is a food truck that makes their own bagels and is really good.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, they do good work. And they do good work. They do bagels in a way that we don't necessarily often see in Los Angeles.
Right, they do the like classic mm-hmm. boiled bagels instead of being like a crappy baked version.
Right. I mean, they do both. They do the boiling and the baking, right? And that's how you get like that crispy
yeah.
outer layer.
Yeah. I just mean like I think with some commercially made bagels, they only bake them and don't boil them.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're very right. So did you know them? You were friends with Evan first or?
I frequented the truck enough that I became friends with Evan.
Okay.
And I talk to Evan like almost every day now. So it's really funny because we're good friends. We have the same lawyer. But yeah, that's how I became friends with him, was just like going to the truck and like chatting.
Okay.
I think he had seen my work and then we started talking after that. And
yeah. You did like an actual, like, is it an iron-on patch?
It's a peel-and-stick patch.
Peel-and-stick patch.
Which
okay.
is awesome because it has, like, ready adhesive and you just stick nice. It on whatever. And the patch itself is like an everything bagel with like giant cartoon like lovey eyes. And it says bagel on the bagel, and then it has metallic silver accents that are like sparkly.
Ooh.
So it's like, you know, like a really kind of like bedroom eyes everything bagel.
So sexy.
I know.
Do you feel like whitefish sandwiches are sexy?
No, I feel like it's kind of embarrassing to own up to be like, I love canned tuna fish with mayonnaise. But I felt like the bagel at the sandwich to go with the aesthetic of the patch I made probably should have been like a sweet bagel. But I was like, for myself,
okay,
I just wanted the whitefish.
Right. So that makes sense.
It was like whitefish on everything with onions, capers, lettuce. What else was on it? Tomato. Yeah.
I like it.
It was good.
Yeah. That sounds amazing. Very classic, too.
Yeah. It's good.
None of these, like, West Coast crazy schmears or anything like that.
He was like, can we please add, I think he may have added cream cheese to it, but I didn't want there to be cream cheese
on Cream cheese on top of the whitefish?
Yeah. I think for my own, I did not.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm not sure about that, Evan. Well, what do you think? So there's this place in Brooklyn, kind of a classic story of a guy who came from a family that owned this place called Ratner's, which was like classic restaurant and in Manhattan. And then like he opened the like cool version of it in mm-hmm. Brooklyn. And he does a whitefish salad, but he uses creme fraiche.
Oh,
so how fancy. Do we, I know. How do we feel about that? Like making this like an upscale dish.
I mean, I just called it whitefish pate. So obviously I was taking myself very seriously.
That's true. That's true. That makes a lot of sense.
It's not like I'm calling it tuna pate, though. I don't know why whitefish got the pate treatment.
I want you to call it tuna pate.
Tuna pate. This tuna is pate very, sandwiches.
Yes, this is very important to me now.
From a restaurant called Subway.
Exactly. Oh, maybe you'll know this. I'm just looking in my notes. I forgot about this. Some people say that the meatiest whitefish comes from Door County in Wisconsin.
Oh.
So there you go.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know.
Fat, happy fish?
Probably. Hopefully we can, like, keep that up. Every time we talk about fish or seafood on
it's
this
depressing.
Podcast. Yeah. It, like, stresses me out a little bit. Because I'm like, yay, it tastes so delicious. But please be very responsible and boring about where you source it. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I know.
I feel like in Minnesota, where, like, the mores that I was talking about, there's, like, 10,000 lakes, right? So,
right.
I mean... Seems like an endless supply, but...
Right. There's enough. So the guy who is like the paterfamilias of Russ and Daughters right now, he says that his dying meal would be a bialy with cream cheese and tomato and smoked salmon and sable.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Sable That'd is very delicious. Expensive.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it's actually cod. It's Pacific cod. That's what sable is.
Oh, really? I didn't know that either.
So the thing about fish is, like, a couple different states have tried to pass laws saying that, like, you'll go to jail if you mislabel your fish because you're doing it to mislead the customers.
Oh, wow.
I know. And I can know that some people do that. But the other thing is that every fish has, like, 4,000 different names. And they're usually just regional variations.
Uh-huh.
So I don't want to, like, get too mad at people. Like, if you go down to the Dory Fleet Fish Market in Newport Beach, it, like, mm-hmm. opens at 5 a.m. It's the fishermen actually bring their catch in from their boat, and they sell it right there. They call black cod sea trout, like, interchangeably. It's like
really?
Black cod and sea trout.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of different names for it.
Huh.
So I wouldn't put anyone in jail. For mislabeling it.
All the Dory fishermen are just like, wait, what'd we do?
Exactly. So your store is in Chinatown, which is kind of LA's coolest neighborhood right now, I want to say.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, when we decided to open up in Chinatown, I don't think we weren't trying to, like, trend forecast or anything.
Okay.
We, like, I knew that I had wanted to open up a shop, and I moved to LA knowing that was a goal of mine.
Okay.
And I live in Glassell Park, and I love Glassell Park a lot. It's like my favorite place that I've lived in LA.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not a lot of like retail shops there. And I wouldn't say it's like a neighborhood where you should open up
right.
a little shop. It's right. definitely very residential. But we looked into Highland Park just because it's so close. But it's insane. Like rent prices are crazy there. Yeah. Just like I feel like it would squash any opportunity to be creative or take risks, especially because Friend Mart grew out of being a pop-up series where we championed local artists and kind of up-and-coming artists that maybe didn't have a super huge following.
Okay.
Just really interesting work that we liked. I was just kind of keeping my eyes open for where we would open up a shop. And, I was like walking around Chinatown after eating one day. And, I found this plaza that was just so amazing. It was like this really, tranquil environment, and which is kind of unique for LA. And,
yeah.
It wasn't like immediately apparent from the street what it was. But it was like kind of, like garden front shops, except that all of the storefronts were vacant.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind
of, that's par for the course with Chinatown. Yeah. I think especially like a lot of people moved out, to the Valley. Like once, you know, it started to get a lot more violent in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt really taken with that environment, and it, you know, encapsulated what I wanted, for the shop. Like I wanted it to be kind of like a secret special spot where people could, you know, we could host larger events celebrating, local artists. And we weren't super concerned with like, you know, being in the middle of everything,
mm-hmm.
more of a destination. And I was okay with that.
Oh, okay.
So we were trying to figure out who owned this plaza for fucking ever because there was no information on it at all, like nothing. And, I couldn't figure it out. And finally I kind of gave up, but I needed a studio anyway, because, I started producing clothing made in Los Angeles, and, I ran out of room in my apartment and I didn't want to be in my apartment anyway anymore. So I was signing a lease with this landlord for the space, and, I asked him if he happened to have anything bigger, because it's just like a fairly small, like 500 square foot studio, kind of close to Philippe's. And he was like, well, I don't, but my uncles do down the street. And I was like way too aggressive. Who are your uncles? And it turned out that his uncles owned Mandarin Plaza.
Perfect.
Which is where Friend Mart is now. And I like harassed him into giving me like their information so that I could get it. And
I feel like you weren't harassing them. Aren't you paying them rent?
I'm paying them rent. This is a good thing. probably from being from the Midwest, like being aggressive at all feels like you're going above and beyond. But I think really I was like, will you please connect me with your uncles?
I mean, and you've had to get aggressive in the last year because of the very shenanigans that have gone on.
Oh, yes, for sure.
I mean, are you allowed to talk about that?
Yes, I can talk about it.
So where does it – wait, let's start at the beginning. And you so basically – places like Zara and Forever 21, like, we know that they rip off independent artists.
Yes.
And that's been, like, a long-established fact, and there's usually nothing that these independent artists can do because their lawyers send them dickhead statements that they don't have the resources to fight back on.
Yeah.
And so they ripped off your design, Zara did.
Yes.
And you decided to fucking go for it.
Well, it's crazy because, you know, with companies that are so invested in the fast fashion world, their whole MO and their business model revolves around stealing trend-facing work. So usually it's like, you know, someone like Chanel, they see like, or like Marc Jacobs or something that's like a little bit more consumer-focused. And so they rip off these like larger fashion names, and people love it because they can afford to buy from larger fashion brands. But I think more recently, these fast fashion companies have started looking toward smaller independent artists, independent clothing designers, because it's harder for independent artists to defend themselves, you know, like.
So you're saying that, like, fast fashion, just as a matter of course, looks at other designers and is like, we're going to take that now.
Oh, that's their whole
okay
MO. That's, like, their business model is, like, taking an item of clothing that's maybe, you know, like, $500, $300, $1,000, whatever, and, you know, reproducing it at a lower price point, like $40.
So how do they get away with ripping off the Chanels and the Marc Jacobses?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know, I've had to learn a lot about copyright and how it deals with fashion and how it deals with design and illustration. With fashion, unfortunately, there's no real way to copyright, you know, trade dress. Like, okay. Louboutin tried to sue Zara, I think, for having, like, red-soled shoes because uh-huh. that's, like, a trade dress trademark of their company, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you see a red-soled shoe and you're like, duh, I know what that is.
Yeah.
But the courts were like, well, I don't think that you can be the only one to have red-soled shoes, even though everybody knows that's shiesty, you know?
Uh-huh.
So it's really hard for fashion designers to defend themselves because if it's just about the shape of an item, or like the way of constructing an item, it's not easy for designers to defend themselves
okay.
that way. But so that extends with independent designers, but if you're doing more, illustration focused clothing accessories, like I am coming from an illustration background,
mm-hmm.
you can, and I do copyright and trademark my items because it is like a finite design that is, you know, like ornamental on an object. So it's easy to just be like, okay, well, this, you know, strawberry, how you drew it is copyrighted to you.
Okay.
So, so I think
they played themselves in going after people like you who are designers, but know how to trademark your work as an illustration.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, also because like, My work is different than like designing like a really beautiful shoe, right?
Okay.
So much of my work is just surface focused. Like it's less about, you know, like the shape of the sweatshirt and more about what's on it.
Okay.
Although
okay.
I'm starting to move into like focusing on both equally.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially I've copywritten what's on top of the garment, right?
Okay.
So Zara, over the past year, starting in, I think, January, started copying, like, one item. And I saw it, and people drew my attention to it. And I didn't know if I could actually go after it. You know, yeah. like, I'd never had to sue anybody before. It's, like, not my favorite thing in the world. Like, of course, I'd love to focus my attention elsewhere.
Right, right.
And I just decided to ignore it.
Okay.
With the first item, because I was just like, I don't know if I want to spend my time doing this.
Yeah.
And maybe it was a little less egregious than the following designs. And it was like, you know, design number two, people started sending it to me and I was like, oh, that sucks. Design number three, I was like starting to feel really helpless because like, what do you do? Like, do I want to devote my savings to right. defending something that is mine. You
right,
know?
Right.
It's, I mean, copyright law is kind of ridiculous anyway because you have to pay to defend something that you made. You know, it's like by putting something out in the world, you're then in like indebted to the government to like be like, no, this is mine finitely, you know?
Okay.
So, you know, I like was kind of putting my head in the sand because I was just like, is it worth it?
Right.
And then, you know, eventually there was a, you know, it like got more and more obvious over time, you know, taking less like, you know, changing less about the design until we got to the point where they were just like straight up copying my work, uh-huh. not changing anything.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think by not speaking up, I was allowing them to step all over me, intellectually,
yeah,
my property,
yeah.
And so I decided that I needed to do something about it, and contacted my lawyer at the time. We like wrote up a cease and desist, and essentially the letter that we got back was just like, it wasn't, we didn't do it. It was, you only have 90,000 fans. We have 90 billion fans.
Right, right.
There is no way that a significant portion of the population will know that this is yours. So, too bad.
Isn't that just beyond infuriating? They weren't even worried about saying whether or not they did it. They were just like, we're bigger than you. It was such a, it's a, sounds such like a
snotty
very,
letter. Yeah. A
very might makes right type of situation.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And like.
And I'm sure they've sent that letter to hundreds of designers before
have.
You.
Yeah. I've gotten, you know, emails from other designers that have been like, I got that same exact letter.
Right.
And I could see how that would be so crushing.
Yes.
To get that letter. Like, you know,
we're popular and you're not.
Yeah. And to be like, well, I guess what do I do? Like, fuck, they're right.
Yeah.
Like, their CEO is literally the richest man in the world.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The richest man in the world.
Wow.
Yes. And then, you know, you're a small independent designer from Los Angeles or wherever.
Yeah.
But I am not one that is like crushed by those things. I'm just like pissed. Like,
that's awesome.
I'm definitely the kind of person where it's like, if you tell me I can't do something, then I'm like, oh yeah, well, I'll fucking show you. Like,
I kind of have that too. Yeah. So I get that.
I think it's a positive thing.
I agree. I'm glad you feel that way. I'm glad you said that.
So I, with their crazy snotty lawyer letter, I just shared it on Twitter and I didn't know if anything would come of it, but I was just so mad.
Mm-hmm.
That I shared it saying, this is what happens when you're an independent designer and you try to defend yourself.
Yeah.
This is the kind of response you get after already pouring in thousands of dollars just to get this dismissive response.
Yeah.
And it took off like crazy, which really surprised me that people cared enough, but people do really care and it's frustrating. And I think a lot of people feel stepped on and like crushed mm-hmm. all the time. And it's empowering for other people too, to see somebody standing up for themselves and also to see other people standing up for that person. And
yeah, I think it's indicative of where we are like financially for people right now, the economy of these younger people who, if you get a job with a big company, you don't even make that much. So
right.
I think more people like of your generation are like, well, shit, I'm going to go out on my own. I'll make a little bit less, but at least it'll be my dream.
Right.
But these big companies can still fuck you over whether you're working for them or not.
Right. Exactly. For sure. Yeah. It's wild.
And so a lawyer decided to help you from that point.
Yes. So Evan from Yeasty Boys recommended his lawyer.
Oh, okay.
Who is amazing. I love Brandon Dorsky. He's incredible.
Shout out to Brandon.
Best lawyer. And he's crazy smart. And, you know, he's an intellectual property lawyer, but typically works with hip hop producers.
Okay.
So it's like hip hop producers and me and bagel truck. he's working on a contingency basis and it's so cut and dry, like
that they copied from you.
Yeah.
Especially because they didn't even deny it.
Yeah.
That was never part of their game plan, was to try and prove that they didn't copy you.
No.
So what do you, like, would you get them to stop copying you, and then do you like get the money that they made off of copying your designs?
Well, we're still pursuing it
right
now. But essentially, because these designs are copywritten, there's like a couple different kinds of damages you can seek.
Okay.
So I don't know how it will play out, but it's so egregious that I feel confident that it will play out well.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it changes the face of how they do business.
Yes.
And how they treat other artists, because after I spoke up, a lot of other artists spoke up that were also affected by them specifically, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. in this year. And I think it was something like 30 other artists or 30 designs from other artists had been also stolen, which makes for like something like 50 designs just from like people that we identified early on. You know, it's only when we found all that stuff, it was like July. So mm-hmm. that was, you know, really only halfway through the year.
Yeah.
Who knew what else was coming out, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just crazy. And I hope that that really changes the face of that business and how they do business, because it's gross.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah.
I totally admire you for doing this.
Oh,
this
thank
is
you.
So great. Especially because, like, you're so young and you're from the Midwest. So, like you said, you're like, more inclined to be like nice and roll over about this kind of stuff. This must be so far out of your comfort zone and wild. And I think it's great that you're doing it.
I don't know. I feel like I've had a lot of people say that it's a scary thing to do. And I guess it is. But also, I'm like, what are they going to do? Kill me? Like,
yeah, that's a good way of looking at
it. I don't, you know, I mean, maybe.
Right, maybe.
But probably not.
But if they're going to kill you, someone else might be just as likely to. So, yeah. Like, whatever.
True. Life's short.
Yeah.
Defend exactly. your intellectual property.
So when everything's all settled, do you think that you will celebrate back home with whitefish pate? Or do you think you might go to New York for whitefish salad?
Definitely New York for whitefish salad.
Okay, that's a good answer. Tuesday, the owner of Friend Mart in LA's Chinatown. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Catherine.
Bye, everybody.